This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, pharmacists at a couple major chains recently walked off the job for a few days to protest an increased workload. We'll find out more about conditions in the industry and what it means for pharmacy customers. First, around 700 people live year-round on isolated Washington Island. For years, residents' access to the internet was slow and often unreliable. Now, Washington Island is the site of a new broadband expansion project. As Evan Casey reports, it's part of a statewide push to connect all Wisconsinites.
Courtney and Eric Desjardins live on Washington Island, which sits off the northern tip of Door County. They own the busy Mann's Mercantile General Store. Its walls are lined with souvenirs as customers fill the aisles. But living on an island doesn't come without its challenges. One of them, slow and spotty internet service.
When you got a business like this where you have, you know, mass customers walking in your door at from open till close, and if you don't have any internet service, you don't have any money coming in.
That's the sound of construction workers unspooling several hundred feet of fiber optic cable. They're at work deep in the woods, about 5 miles from Mann's Mercantile. It's a cool September day, and workers wearing hard hats are high up on a utility pole with the cable. When it's installed, they'll go from having slow and unreliable internet to lightning-fast service. The work is part of a new $7 million fiber optic network that's running across the islands. The goal is to bring the faster service to any home and business that wants it. Robert Cornell is a manager of the Washington Island Electric Co-op and the driving force behind the project. He likes to drive across the 35 square mile islands and count the homes with the service.
It's kind of fun because this is where we started, and I can go down the road and I can say, he has it, they have it, they have it, they have it. We've got them connected, and everybody on this road is connected.
Nearly 250 locations on the island now have the service. That includes Mann's Mercantile. The project is partly funded by the co-op, but around half of it is being paid for through grants, including $2.5 million from the Wisconsin Public Service Commission. The state has been working to expand broadband access, especially in rural areas, for over a decade. But almost a quarter of a million homes and businesses still don't have access to internet that can support basic video streaming. Federal grants support broadband expansion through the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program. It goes by the acronym BEAD. Wisconsin got $1 billion from that program. Public Service Commission Chair Rebecca Vock says it'll take more than just the federal money to reach all Wisconsinites with connections fast enough to support video calls and gaming.
We know it's going to take more than the BEAD allocation to get everybody to 100 by 2030. But we're confident that we're going to make incredible progress by 2030.
Earlier this year, state lawmakers rejected a proposal from Governor Tony Evers to expand broadband access. Vock believes that'll slow the process down. On Washington Island, Michael Gillespie doesn't have the new service at his home yet, but he does have it at his office. He says it helps with downloading and sending large PDF documents needed for his job as a plumber.
We're usually kind of the last for new technologies. They say plumbing came here 20 years after it came to the mainland in the, you know, early part of the century, but we're leaders in this, so that's pretty exciting that little Washington Island can have fiber optic internet.
It could be several more years until everyone has access across the state. And as time goes on, old infrastructure may not be suitable to bring high speeds to everyone as technology continues to grow and evolve. But for Gillespie and his wife Danny, the new infrastructure can't come to their home fast enough. Robert Cornell often jokes with Danny about the pace of the project.
Cannot wait till the high speed to go to my house.
It's coming.
I keep asking, when is it my house?
We move it out a week every time you ask.
The project is expected to be completed by the end of 2025. Evan Casey, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, pharmacy workers at Walgreens and CVS Pharmacy staged a three-day walkout at some locations last week in protest of what they describe as inadequate staffing and poor working conditions. The exact scale and impact of the walkouts is unclear, as statements released by Walgreens and CVS conflict with the accounts of some workers and protest organizers. Our next guest is an expert on the pharmacy workforce. He's done research about pharmacist workload, burnout, and job turnover. He joins us now for a look at the profession and how it all affects pharmacy customers. You can join in at 1, 2, 3, 4. As a customer, have you noticed maybe longer wait times, fewer hours at the local pharmacy? Is there a local pharmacy where you are? And if you work as a pharmacist or a pharmacy technician, what has changed in that profession over the last few years? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. David Mott is a professor of social and administrative sciences at the School of Pharmacy at UW-Madison. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. It's good to join you. Thanks for having me.
Can you talk about some of the concerns that pharmacy workers were raising in these three-day walkouts at some of these chain stores?
Yeah, I think, a lot of these pharmacists, their walkouts really are a desperate attempt to draw attention to the poor working conditions and the resulting burnout that a lot of them say have been ignored for far too long. And we conducted a National Pharmacist Workforce Study in 2022, and really we were trying to figure out what were the impacts of COVID and where are pharmacists right now in terms of their work situations. And it was pretty shocking that about 60% of chain pharmacists in that study, they reported high levels of work exhaustion, and nearly 80% of them reported low levels of job satisfaction. So you've got a group of pharmacists out there that are working in these work environments, and it was getting bad before COVID, and now after COVID, it's gotten to a boiling point, I think, and they've kind of decided that they need to walk out and draw some attention to their situation.
Yeah, in that study, you looked at pharmacists who'd worked at different locations, because pharmacists might work at hospitals or health clinics, small independent pharmacies, or these big chains. If I read your results right, Dave, these large chain pharmacists were feeling burnout, heavy workload, and more than in those other settings. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Certainly across all the settings, as you said, there are pharmacists that are burned out or have low job satisfaction. But as you said, and what we found in the main setting, that's where we see the worst situations, where the most pharmacists are burned out, the highest job satisfaction, and really the highest intention to leave their positions across all those settings.
So what's going on at those big chain pharmacies that's driving this?
Yeah, as I said, kind of what's been happening is this has been brewing for a while, probably, 2014, 2015 sort of ramped up. And another study we did in 2019 showed that things have been growing in terms of burnout and poor satisfaction. And COVID was really, a difficult situation for all of healthcare providers. And I think one of the things that happened in pharmacy is pharmacists became really important access points for COVID vaccinations and other flu vaccinations. And unfortunately, in those chain environments, providing those COVID vaccinations just added on to the work that pharmacists were already doing in those environments in terms of dispensing prescriptions. And staffing levels, both pharmacist staffing levels and technician staffing levels, were decreasing. And you've got this perfect storm of decreased staff, both pharmacists and pharmacy technicians, combined with increased demand for vaccinations and prescription drugs. And it has just led to really poor work environments for these pharmacists. They are stressed out. They have way too much to do. They don't have enough staffing and a lot of demands from consumers to receive vaccinations or to receive dispensed prescription drugs. So it's a pretty difficult situation for those pharmacists.
I want to talk about that understaffing situation in two parts. First of all, pharmacists themselves, is there a pharmacist shortage where there just aren't enough to go around? And if I'm running a chain store, I'm struggling to bring them on?
Yeah, so the shortage situation is interesting. So before we did our study in 2022, actually, the HRSA, federal group that kind of looks at the status of health professionals, sort of predicted that there was going to be a surplus of pharmacists moving forward in the next 10 years or so. But recently, those projections have changed, where there's going to be a shortage now of pharmacists moving forward. So what's really going to be difficult, I think, for the change is a couple things. One is, if there is going to be the shortage moving forward, it's going to be hard for everybody, every employer, to attract pharmacists. But I think what's going to be really hard for the chains is, with all these newspaper articles and these walkouts, there's certainly a lot of information that chain environments may not be the best place for pharmacists to be working. So I just wonder, whether pharmacists are going to say, I am not going to go to one of these work environments where there's a shortage of pharmacists, there's a shortage of technicians, there's long lines of patients, there's a lot of demand for my services. I don't have time to practice pharmacy the way that I want to practice pharmacy. So the shortage combined with sort of this information that these environments may not be so great, that may not be a good situation for these chains in terms of hiring more pharmacists.
All right. And then part two, that was the pharmacists, pharmacy technicians, a shortage there, or at least not enough people, pharmacists are saying, on their staffs. What is happening there?
Yeah. So this is something that came up during the pandemic. A lot of technicians, pharmacies were very stressful work environments, a lot of health risks because of COVID. And I think a lot of technicians were being underpaid. A lot of them just decided to leave chain environments and being pharmacy technicians. And they pursued jobs in other sectors. And I think it's been really hard for chains and other pharmacies that employ technicians to bring technicians back. They need to improve work conditions for technicians. They need to increase pay for technicians. And they're beginning to see some information that chains are beginning to raise their wage rates to try to draw technicians back into those work environments.
Talking to Dave Mott, professor of social and administrative sciences at the School of Pharmacy at UW-Madison, about the causes and impacts of recent walkouts by some chain store pharmacy workers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed changes in your experience at the pharmacy in the years, especially since the pandemic? Do you notice longer lines or wait times or shorter hours if you work in this field or have left work in this field? Love to hear your perspective on that, whether you were working at a chain pharmacy, independent hospital, health clinic, you name it. What is your perspective on what's going on in pharmacies? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Dave Mott, professor of social and administrative sciences at the School of Pharmacy at UW-Madison. Talking about why pharmacy workers at CVS and Walgreens walked off the job at some locations, and how understaffing and increasing workloads impact customer experience and even maybe customer safety. You could join in at 800-642-1234. As a customer, do you feel like you have a lot of face time with your pharmacist when you need it? Have you ever had a mistake happen with your prescription? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you if you work in the business as well. Dave, are we seeing solutions? Sticking with the chain stores for a moment, are we seeing efforts to fix these things? Anything successful that you can point to?
Yeah, so there have been some reports that the large chains are making investments or trying to make investments into the workforce. There's some reports of a few months ago of organizations raising wage rates, trying to offer signing bonuses to compensate pharmacists better. I think the concern about the signing bonuses, though, to have pharmacists work there is, again, you just kind of have to wonder, if you're a pharmacist, the $70,000 signing bonus, you know, what does that mean? You know, why is this firm offering me $70,000 signing bonus to come there? It kind of raises questions about perhaps maybe that work environment isn't as positive as some other places that, you know, frankly, may not be offering a signing bonus. So we're seeing some reports that the chains are trying to increase pharmacists' wages. I also mentioned there's some reports that technician wages are being increased. I know some of the chains are trying to leverage technology and free up pharmacists' time at sites where prescriptions are dispensed. And what they're trying to do is use technology to fill prescriptions at central locations, especially refill prescriptions, and then have them brought to the local outlets to be dispensed to patients. The idea being there is that the pharmacists that are at those local sites don't have to spend so much time in the actual dispensing of these refill prescriptions. They can be done somewhere else and brought in, therefore freeing up the pharmacist's time to provide vaccinations or to check prescriptions that come in and talk with patients when they're having prescriptions dispensed. So there's some reports that this stuff is happening, but you know, you just don't know how long it's going to take for the situation to improve.
We heard from Dan in Muskego who couldn't stay on the line. He said he'd been experiencing poor service at a local chain pharmacy in his area. Finally left it, went to a big box store that's providing pharmacy services. Dave, are we at a point where you think customers are really feeling the impact of pharmacist overwork and burnout?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there was a recent Wall Street Journal report that showed that customer satisfaction with the large chains has dropped a lot recently, and it's probably because of the situation in these environments. You hear things about long lines, people not being really happy with each other, and the delays. So there's probably some screaming and yelling going on in those environments. We've heard things that pharmacists are being told to spend more time on providing vaccinations. What happens then if they're short-staffed? There's going to be a huge delay in filling prescriptions and dispensing them. So I've heard of patients going into pharmacies and not having prescriptions ready when they were told they were going to be ready. So these are all things that are going to make customers, patients very unhappy. They're probably things that have been brewing again. Like I said, the storm has been brewing. And like the caller said, at some point, I would imagine consumers are going to say, I'm not going to this pharmacy anymore. I'm going to try to get my prescription drugs or other services at another pharmacy. So I think that's going to happen more, I think.
Thanks for sharing your thoughts, Dan, at 800-642-1234. Talking about the pharmacy business, a lot of overwork in all fields, all venues of the pharmacy profession, especially chain stores. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dave, are we worried about potential safety concerns if we have pharmacists filling more, prescriptions per hour, per day, things like that? Do we worry about the potential for mistakes?
Yeah, this is a great question. This is one of the things we asked about in our study in 2022, where we asked pharmacists to describe their work environments for us. And we found out that a lot of pharmacists felt that they were being asked to do way too many activities without enough staffing, that their job extends beyond the typical work day, that they don't have autonomy in providing care and services the way that they want to. And then, of course, I mentioned the understaffing, and that a lot of chains focus on workload metrics. It's a very assembly line efficiency-driven business. They want pharmacists and technicians to produce prescriptions and services as fast as possible. And those were some of the characteristics in the work environment. And the thing that was really distressing is then pharmacists shared with us how those work characteristics then impact their perceptions of patient safety. And a lot of times we found over 80% of pharmacists that were experiencing these negative work characteristics, that they said that these characteristics significantly reduced patient medication safety in those work environments. So that's certainly a huge concern. We're not saying that is leading to errors every time, but certainly when pharmacists are saying that there's this perception that patient medication safety is being impacted, that's telling you that they do not feel comfortable, that they're not spending enough time making sure that what they're doing is as accurate and as safe as possible. And when you're in a situation like that, pharmacists have to work harder. They're stressed out more because they do not want to make a mistake. But when you're in an environment where you got a lot of stuff going on and you're not able to spend the time that you need to make sure things are accurate and safe, that's going to lead to a lot of stress, a lot of burnout, a lot of overwork and stressing to make sure that those medications are safe. And that, pharmacists are kind of the safety net, right? They're the last point before a drug is dispensed to a patient. So that's a really, really critical step in our healthcare system to make sure pharmacists are checking everything to make sure everything is 100% accurate.
Oh, and related to that, Dave, if I go into a pharmacy and get a prescription refill, I'm happy to just pay and go. If I get a new prescription for the first time, I often have questions for the pharmacist. Does the pharmacist in a lot of these situations have time for Rob's questions?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what it all boils down to is me personally, when I have a new prescription, like you said, I want to go in and make sure all my questions are going to be answered. Or if the pharmacist has questions for me about how I'm going to take this or show me the medication, right? Pour it out in their hand and show me this is the color of these tablets or this is the size of these capsules. You know, that's even important on refill prescriptions, just to make sure everything's accurate. And I think when you're interacting with a health professional who's very stressed, who's very rushed, who just doesn't have the time to talk with you, yeah, that can be pretty disconcerting that they're not spending the right amount of time with you, or maybe they're not completely answering your questions for you. So again, another way that patients are potentially going to be impacted by this situation.
Dave, in just our last minute or so, another related issue is some communities don't really even have access to a pharmacy nearby. Are you concerned about, and maybe connected to concerns about labor availability, are you worried about pharmacy deserts in some communities?
Yeah, for sure. This is something that's been going on over the past 10 or 15 years, is pharmacies closing in areas, especially in rural areas or areas in inner cities, where the pharmacy is a critical access point for healthcare. In some of these areas, having a pharmacist, a trained healthcare provider, a pharmacist in those areas is incredibly important for access to drugs, information, vaccination. So when we get into the situation where the only pharmacy in town is closing, either because they can't attract workers or the economic model doesn't support the business anymore, then we're in the situation where you've got vulnerable patients that are in these vulnerable areas not having access to a healthcare provider. And yeah, it can be pretty significant in terms of the population health impacts in those areas. So something that's very concerning.
Dave, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
That's Dave Mott, Professor of Social and Administrative Sciences at the School of Pharmacy at UW-Madison. Talked to him about recent walkouts by pharmacy workers at CVS and Walgreens to draw attention to what they say is inadequate staffing and poor working conditions. Still time to share your thoughts, your experiences. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. In some cases, people can get effective hospital care in their own homes. Kate and her guests dig into the hospital at home concept. And again, if you have a personal experience with that, with yourself, a loved one, or as somebody providing that kind of service, you can share your comments and thoughts right now. Email ideas@WPR.org. Then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 7 on the Ideas Network. Today marks a big moment for fans of, well, this. It's the anniversary of the creation of modern public broadcasting as we know it as a part of federal law. On this day in 1967, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Public Broadcasting Act into law, setting the stage for the creation of NPR on the radio, PBS on TV, and marking a big moment for local and state affiliates as well. Now, public broadcasting had been around for a long time in Wisconsin before 1967. Public TV as a network came on the air in the state in 1954. Wisconsin Public Radio goes back even further. The starting year depends on how you slice it. What we could call a radio network goes back to maybe 1947. There were some earlier simulcasts. If you want to take the history back to the first experimental broadcast, well, mark that to 1914 or 15. One early Morse code transmission was the results of a Wisconsin-Ohio State basketball game on February 17th, 1917. Couldn't find the results of that one, though. Dash, 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 dot, dash. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, are you a Felicity, a Kirsten, a Samantha, a Molly, or a Josefina? That's a common question among fans of the American Girl line of books and dolls. The brand was founded by Pleasant Roland in Wisconsin back in the 1980s, went on to become an icon of girlhood for many in the 1990s and 2000s. Beyond the dolls and books, American Girl turned into a kind of lifestyle brand for young girls, including but not limited to theater kits, recipes, paper dolls, a magazine, and advice books on health and friendship. Our next guest hosts a podcast that revisits the American Girl series through a historical lens. They've just co-authored a new book exploring what they call the wonderful and wild world of American Girl fandom. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you have an American Girl doll when you were younger, or did your kids? Did you especially relate to any of the characters or their stories? What kind of influence has American Girl had in your life and your family. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Allison Horrocks and Mary Mahoney are historians, co-hosts of the Dolls of Our Lives podcast, and co-authors of that new book. It's called Dolls of Our Lives, Why We Can't Quit, American Girl. Allison and Mary, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us.
Mary, let's start with you. You say in the podcast, in the book, that you're a total Molly. Now, for people who aren't familiar with the American Girl lineup, we're pretty familiar here in Wisconsin, but tell us a little bit about how you connected to one of the particular American Girl characters.
Sure. So I received Molly when I was 9 years old on Christmas Eve. So she was the first American Girl doll I'd ever heard of or met. And she lives during World War II. And I just was so fascinated by her books. I was always more of a fan of the books than dolls in particular. But really, for me, what made Molly my favorite was that she kind of, her stories function as a bridge to one of my favorite people in my life, my grandmother, who I'm named after, who I affectionately called Fluffy, who, you know, didn't read the books, but because I could ask her lots of questions about growing up during World War II and if she had a victory garden and things like that.
And Allison, you are also a longtime Molly. What led to that connection for you?
So my story is actually really similar. I also received a Molly as my entry point into the American Girl brand, but her stories were something that just really fascinated me. I love to kind of step inside someone else's life, and I was very jealous of her bangs and her eyewear. So I did try to kind of facilitate the eyewear piece by just like failing an eye exam. That was not successful. Now I don't have to try. I fail all on my own. I got a haircut not long after getting my Molly. There was something about her spirit, her tenacity, her patriotism, all those things were just so fascinating to me. And for me, it was a bridge to my mom, who was a doll collector, loved playing with dolls and dollware. So it was just kind of a whole new exciting chapter for me as a kid.
Now, I asked about your Molly origin stories to kind of demonstrate that there's a connection with American Girl dolls that I don't think we see with other lines. Mary, what is it about American Girl that can have that deep level of personal connection for the two of you and for so many of your podcast listeners?
Well, I think, you know, speaking for myself and for the stories that we've been lucky enough to collect from a lot of our listeners that are in the book, I think the design of the brand itself lent itself to that kind of lifelong connection. When Pleasant Rolland invented American Girl, she dreamed of the dolls and the books together as something that would encourage girls to both see themselves at the center of the story and also to learn through play, to read the stories, but then reinforce it by playing with the dolls and the world of accessories. And she also saw this as something that would be passed down. At a speech that she gave at Colonial Williamsburg at the launch of Felicity, she gives us really beautiful, offers these remarks about, you know, envisioning this being passed down kind of matrilineally from mother to daughter and so on. And we've lived long enough that we've actually seen that happen. We are not parents ourselves, but we have a lot of listeners who are kind of reinvigorated with the brand by getting the chance to share them with a whole new generation.
And Allison, I should point out in the podcast, in the book, you and Mary are fans clearly of American Girl. You're not boosters. You don't look at it without criticism. Can you talk about, you know, as you look back as a grown-up to your childhood experience, some of the questions that were raised?
Yeah, I think we've joked on the podcast that we're not in the pocket of big doll, so to speak, that, you know, we have enough distance from these things, both by aging and having some time away. You know, I collect dolls actively now along with accessories, but that's something I didn't do for a period of time. So I was able to kind of revisit the stories, revisit my collection, go back to this idea of collecting. And I think having criticism of things that you once loved is really good. It's a positive thing to do. We've never marketed this as a purely nostalgic trip down memory lane because we're really curious in what adults think about these things now and how new generations are interpreting them.
Talking to Allison Horrocks and Mary Mahoney, authors of the new book, Dolls of Our Lives, Why We Can't Quit American Girl. You can follow their podcast, Dolls of Our Lives, as well. We asked around Wisconsin Public Radio here for some memories of American Girl. Here's one of the responses we got.
This is Maureen McCollum, host of WPR's Wisconsin Life, and I am so happy to talk about my Kirsten doll. For those who don't know, Kirsten was one of the original American Girl dolls. She was a Swedish immigrant. Her family moved to the prairies of Minnesota sometime in the 1800s. And the Kirsten doll itself was one of my most treasured fancy possessions. My Aunt Mo gifted her to me when I was maybe 5 or 6. And then every Christmas or birthday, my aunt would send me another outfit or a little accessory to go with my Kirsten doll. And I actually just recently unearthed my Kirsten doll, pulled her out of a box, smelled super musty, but the dresses and the doll itself, like this wave of emotions came over me. Just this love for this doll returned and remembering how special she was. It's a feeling that just hasn't gone away over all these years.
Mary, can you talk? I'm guessing you've heard that from a lot of your podcast listeners, that personal connection, as Maureen said, after all those years.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's such a powerful thing. I've heard stories like that so many times and obviously have experienced that myself. And, you know, what's really interesting is as she was talking, I was laughing because Allison and I had no memory of the stories of those books before we reread them on the show. And yet we could swear to anyone that they were so formative, not only to us as people, but of our choice to become historians. Like, for example, spoiler alert, Kirsten's best friend dies en route, you know, on their journey out west from cholera. And it's extremely tragic and traumatic for many people, apparently not us, because we had no memory of that before we sat down to reread those books.
And Allison, that is a common theme in a lot of these books. There are pretty traumatic situations that a lot of these doll-based characters face in their stories.
Yeah, the authors who were chosen by first, you know, Pleasant Rolland with her early company, you know, she came out of a background of education and media. And even the most recent authors, you know, perhaps most notably Britt Bennett, these are people who care a lot about telling great stories with children and for children. So they're not shying away from difficult topics. And we hear so often from people that this was the first time they really learned something real about a topic such as slavery. Even the books that take us to the War of 1812, a largely forgotten chapter in US history, they give us kind of these harrowing incidents where kids are doing things we don't expect. I don't know that we want to encourage children to be part of, you know, cannonball smuggling schemes, but we can all be proud, right, of a girl who frees herself from slavery. So they really give you a spectrum to dive into.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Liz is with us in Lyon. Liz, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about Liz?
I agree with both of you. I loved Molly because I couldn't get any information out of my grandfather. He refused to speak about his service in World War II, and I was obsessed with it at a young age.
And I think we lost Liz, but I think our producer, she's getting to the point that the books gave her some of that background. Mary, that reminds me, I think it was you talking about your grandma in the book where the Molly books were, even though she didn't read them, as I recall, the Molly books gave you a lot of conversation starters to talk about her life in the, I think, the Depression and World War II eras.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, you know, my grandmother, like it sounds like the, Liz's grandfather, didn't really want to talk about that period in her life voluntarily because it was a tough period of her life. There was a lot of privation and challenges. But because I could use the language of the Molly books, she really, you know, did satisfy my curiosity. And I learned so much about her that I probably wouldn't otherwise have known. And my own grandfather served in the war as well. And he passed away before I was born. So these books also are a way for me to invite her to share with me, you know, things about the life of a person I would never get to meet. So that was, you know, really special and important.
Thanks a lot for that call, Liz. Sorry we lost you at 800-642-1234. Michelle joins us now in Janesville. Michelle, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to make the comment that as an elementary teacher, I incorporated the Felicity series into my third grade classroom, and we did a whole unit study on the American Revolution using Felicity as our main source.
Interesting. And did the kids respond to that, Michelle?
You know, even like the girls were having an American Girl craze at that point mm-hmm. in time, but the boys really enjoyed the historical part of it. We found an interactive website that I pulled up on the smart board. We did crafting projects. We did cooking. Yeah, it was a great resource for us to use.
Michelle, thanks a lot for that call. That the girl and boy thing reminds me, was it you, Allison? I can't remember, where you would be read to, and the brothers in the family didn't want to have anything to do with this because it's a girl. But wait, they keep showing up to hear the books being read out loud.
That was actually...
That's Mary's brother.
That was Mary. I'm sorry.
That's my
okay.
brothers. Yeah, no, that's okay. But yeah, they avowedly said it wasn't for them. It was girls' stuff. But then one by one, they would join us. And we really all loved those books together.
Thanks a lot for that call. And the idea of this as part of a teaching tool, Allison, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think what's so great about that phone call is in the Felicity books and any of these series, you see kids having a really important role in history. So kids are active agents and they're not just experiencing something of the past, but they're going out and sometimes they're doing things that maybe we're not so sure about as adults looking back. That's what creates some of the comedy and tension. But I think for any kind of kid to see that children experience the revolution in a certain way, that's something they're probably really not likely to get in textbooks. And you know, I talk about child labor with kids almost every day at my job, and hearing about kids in history can sometimes still be a novel thing.
Thanks again for that call, Michelle, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Mary Mahoney and Allison Horrocks. They are co-hosts of the podcast Dolls of Our Lives. Their new book is called Dolls of Our Lives, Why We Can't Quit American Girl. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a story to share about American Girl dolls in your own life or maybe a family member? Do you have questions for our guests about some of what they've explored in their podcast or the new book? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Mary Mahoney and Allison Horrocks, co-hosts of the Dolls of Our Lives podcast, co-authors of a new book by the same name that explores the cultural impact, nostalgia, and more surrounding the American Girl brand of dolls. Still time for you to join in with your thoughts, your experiences with American Girl. Join in at 800-642-1234 as a kid, as a parent, maybe as an employee of the company. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Again, we asked our WPR colleagues to share stories. Our own Rochelle Wilson had a deep cut to share.
So I have an American Girl's deep cut. I used to play the American Girl's premiere, an educational computer game that came on a CD-ROM back in the 90s. Basically, you could play with different American Girl characters and create these little stage plays on the computer with your own dialogue and movements. And my sisters and I loved to put little plays together. And it was just one of the ways that I connected with American Girl.
Mary, it's not just the books and dolls. And in the book, you write about people taking it further, using social media now to do, in effect, their own fan fiction types of videos. How much have people taken the original premises and run with them?
Well, you could say people are living out loud. They're taking a lot of latitude, and I'm here for it. You might imagine it as a kind of fan fiction or just kind of a re-engagement with the brand to, in some cases, you know, reignite that nostalgia you have for a childhood love of the brand, like the computer game, or to kind of incorporate more representation into a character story that you wish had been there at the start. So there's Instagram accounts like Lesbian Kirsten that argues just that Kirsten was a lesbian or is a lesbian, I should say, and, you know, just creates representation around that. There's a lot of great interpreter or living history accounts that imagine this. And new kinds of stories. There's so much there, and it's really beautiful. We just had the photographer Sydney Paulson on our show. Her account is at Five Hens and Cockatiels on Instagram, and she works with the brand directly, doing stage photographs with the dolls, recreating movie scenes, and also of course scenes from the brand. So a lot of really interesting stuff out there.
Allison, something I wanted to get into before we run out of time is American Girl dolls and their connection with race and representation of people from different backgrounds. Can you talk a little bit about how that's evolved over the decades?
We've had, you know, really the privilege of a lot of people reaching out to us and sharing their stories, which are different from our own. And there's been some really fantastic think pieces. Aisha Harris has written extensively about the meaning of the Addie doll and her connections both to slavery and self-liberation. I think what has been really fascinating about doing the show is we get to be kind of this listening space. You know, you imagine a podcast as projecting out, but we hear so much from people who have these completely varied relationships with characters such as Josefina or Courtney or Kirsten. And the doll might be a kind of mirror for them in some way, or it might be a window to exploring something else, or they may have decided that it's too fraught, a relationship with a certain character. And so they've chosen to no longer own that doll or to do something different with it. So, you know, I think from think pieces to decisions people make about their own closets and their own collections, adults are generally really thoughtful about how they engage with American Girl.
Listeners can find a link to a Central Time conversation with Aisha Harris about the Addie doll at WPR.org. Just search our archives. We are talking to Mary Mahoney and Allison Horrocks. Their new book is called Dolls of Our Lives, Why We Can't Quit American Girl. Back to your calls now. Janine is with us in Madison. Janine, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to tell us about Janine?
We were very lucky, and my mother-in-law worked for the Pleasant Company when Pleasant owned it. And all of her granddaughters received dolls that were signed by Pleasant. So, cherished dolls through our family.
Wow, Janine, that is fantastic. Do you still have yours, I should ask?
Well, it's actually my daughter's.
Your daughter's,
and
I'm sorry, yes.
We still have it in box because we're like, she had a whole bunch of other Pleasant Company dolls because she played with those. The signed one stayed in the box. But she was a very lucky girl because she grew up getting Pleasant Company paraphernalia for many years.
Thank you so much for sharing that story, Janine. Yeah, and we've heard some other stories of people, you know, when they have sales by the company locally in the Wisconsin area, having memories of finding those. Mary, the idea of the American Girl dolls as collector items, it seems like most people didn't just leave them in boxes. Do I have that wrong?
No, I mean, I think there's both. Allison's probably better to comment on this as a fellow collector, but I think they're both very well loved, but then some do actually keep them in pristine condition. So Allison, are yours more actively loved or do you keep yours in boxes?
Gosh, none of my dolls have seen a box since the day that they arrived on my front step. I was the same way with my Barbies, and from my family level, the play was always encouraged. And there are folks who say, gosh, you know, I wish I had really kept this more pristine. You know, you can always buy, someone is always willing to sell it, right, for some amount, but you can never get back the time that you enjoy playing with them. So that's how I rationalize having ruined a number of my dolls.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
And the price of the American Girl dolls is something you tackle in the book a little bit. It's a barrier to entry for some people that raises some concerns, I think. Mary, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's a very real concern. I think Pleasant at the time would say that when American Girl debuted, she said, you know, a Nintendo game system costs far more than an American Girl doll and the books. So, you know, this is not a fair critique, but I think for many families and people, you know, these dolls were beyond reach. And a lot of listeners have shared with us that this was sometimes occasioned the first real conversations they had about money as a family when they would ask for a doll for a birthday. And, you know, it was just not in the budget. And some fans grew up as adults, you know, with the dream of buying a doll for themselves, even as, you know, folks who aren't parents, just to kind of like as a kind of wish fulfillment of a childhood wish. But I do think that those class barriers are real and, you know, definitely something that endures with the brand.
Allison, something I got to ask. Now, sometimes when I go back and read a cherished book from my youth, sometimes it's great. Sometimes it doesn't hold up. What was the experience like of picking up these books that you'd read and, as Mary mentioned earlier, mostly forgotten? Was it fun to read them again?
Oh, they're definitely fun to reread. I think Molly was probably the hardest because we have, you know, just romanticized certain ideas and qualities about her. And there are pages where you're just so reminded as a reader in your 30s that she's nine, you know, or she's 10 years old and she's grappling with things. She and I still have a lot in common. Like, we won't eat turnips, you know, that's like an early Molly reference. But the truth is, it's a lot of fun to revisit these things. I think if you go in with an open mind, right, and you're willing to see how the text hasn't changed, but you have, and that can be a great experience.
We'll leave it there. Allison and Mary, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Allison Horrocks and Mary Mahoney are historians and co-hosts of the Dolls of Our Lives podcast. We've been talking about the cultural legacy of the Wisconsin-based American Girl brand and their new book, Dolls of Our Lives, Why We Can't Quit American Girl. You can keep sharing your stories over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, there are many scams out there that can come to us on a phone call, a text, an email, or a website. We'll get some of the latest advice on how to stay safe with the state's top consumer protection office. And there are fewer people in the average Wisconsin household these days. That's creating a mismatch in our housing market. Find out what that means for your living situation now and in the future. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to the director of the new UW-Madison Center for Interfaith Dialogue about how to talk about contentious religious issues like the war in Gaza with people who have different faith backgrounds than our own. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.